This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Herding Code. This week we're going to do a roundup of browsers. A lot of new stuff going on in the browser world, so we'll just kind of do a recap of what's out there. First of all, what's everyone's opinions on Chrome so far? I think one thing that was interesting is a lot of people pointed out the coolness of the per-process isolation, but then the IE guys were kind of quick to say, hey, we have per-process isolation too.
Yeah, in beta 2 of IE 8, they do.
What's different between those?
Between IE 8 and Chrome?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of difference in the implement, not necessarily in the implementation, but the way that the UI handles it. Internet Explorer will, if a tab crashes, it will try to restart it a few times before it gives up and says, you know, I don't know what's going on with this HTML you're throwing at me, but it ain't working, so I'm shutting it down. So if the tab crashes, it will immediately try to bring it back up and reload the page, whereas Chrome will just kind of let things go. John Resig had posted a tweet where he said he had a tab open all the time that just had a while loop that was looping over true, so while true in the script tag on it. And it was just, you know, there was no way to exit the loop, so it's just had no problem running it forever in the tab. And I don't think, well, no, that's not true. So I was going to say, I don't think that IE has a process manager built into it, and it doesn't, but it does have the Windows process manager, which will show tabs as new processes and allow you to kill them. Scott Hanselman had a post where, you know, he would go through and kill individual processes, like one process in IE Explorer was hosting a Flash plugin. So when he killed that process, it killed the plugin in the page. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
So killed the specific plugin but left the page up and running.
Or maybe he was talking about Chrome in that case.
You know, I think it was Chrome, because I remember, you know, the whole comic book thing that they used to show off the new features. Mm-hmm. And I remember they were saying, we've got per tab isolation, but we also have layer isolation. So there's like the plugins have a separation, and the rendering and the JavaScript have the isolation. So the JavaScript can crash, but that doesn't kill the rendering and that kind of thing.
So. Right. I haven't used the IE Explorer 8 developer tools any. I haven't installed one in a virtual machine like a responsible developer would yet.
You guys are sissies. So on my development machine, I've got IE 8 beta 2 running. But, you know, I have to say beta 1 was stable, but rendering was not good on a lot of sites, just because it was more, you know, the way they were doing standards compliance. IE 8 beta 2 has been just rock solid, and the rendering has been no problem at all. If pages don't render well, you can just click the thing in the browser bar, and it switches to compatibility mode. And what you were talking about there with the developer toolbar, it's great. Like, I used to use the IE7 developer toolbar, and I really liked it. And then the IE8 beta 1 toolbar came out, and it didn't work very well at all. It had a lot of the features cut out. But the beta 2 toolbar, I was just using it this evening. It's useful. It's similar to Firebug. There's some things that are different, but in general, as far as what I can do with it, I it's not frustrating at all to use. It's the same sort of experience. Kevin?
Yeah, on the tab isolation thing, one thing I wasn't clear on, I haven't used IE 8 yet. I've only used Chrome, partly because, you know, installing IE 8 is so damn invasive in your machine. But somebody was tweeting, I think it was Brad Wilson, was tweeting about how IE 8's process isolation isn't per tab. That is, each tab doesn't necessarily get its own process. There's like some pool of processes that is shared amongst the tabs. It wasn't entirely clear. I was curious if you knew how that worked.
I don't.
You're useless to me.
No, I don't know. I don't know exactly how, you know, if there's a process pool or how IE Explorer is done. I do know that they're using jobs instead of actual processes, or new, you know, jobs the using create job object and assign process to job object and junk like that, which some of you guys that deal more at the lower levels may know more about, and why they're good and why they're better than just creating a new process. But I haven't really delved into the per process isolation IE8. It kind of surprised me when I heard about it. I didn't realize that. I guess it wasn't something that they had really touted as much as Chrome did when it was released.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the two browsers working independently came up with what is essentially the same, idea, the same model.
Well, one thing that is pretty different between them, and this is kind of a huge difference between all the browsers now, or a major area of innovation, is JavaScript. So Chrome's using this. I remember early on that one of the things the IE team was talking about with IE8 was that performance was going to be greatly improved in IE8, and it was pretty fast. And I loaded up beta 2, and I'm like, this is cool. And then the next week, Chrome came out and just kind of crushed it as far as speed. And I'm curious what your guys' opinions have been on JavaScript performance and where things are going. Scott?
The benchmarks that John Resig posted comparing all of the absolutely latest versions of SpiderMonkey, TraceMonkey, SquirrelFish, V8, and the ever so aptly named IE JScript engine were fascinating to me. Using the SunSpider benchmark, which is put out by WebKit, and it's more of a pure JavaScript benchmark. Not no DOM manipulation, no AJAX calls, no nothing like that. Just pure JavaScript functionality. IE7 was just dog slow, whereas IE8 Beta 2 was more in line with some of these cutting edge JavaScript engines that have been coming out, like the V8 engine and SquirrelFish. He was using his Dromeo benchmark, John was. Which is more of a real-world test, so it goes through and it manipulates the DOM and does lots of JavaScript stuff related to manipulating the DOM. And they were all pretty even. Safari was the overall winner with that, and he couldn't run any benchmarks on IE because it kept crashing on the his test suite. But it's interesting that as soon as JavaScript kind of became this thing that people had to have and lots of people were depending on it, and more importantly, there was more money put into it, suddenly all these JavaScript engines kind of got better all at once. All through the late 90s and early 2000s, we just kind of hobbled along with whatever we had and, cobbling crap together out of the little JavaScript engine that could in both, both the browsers we really had to worry about. And now suddenly they're, throwing stuff at it, like jitting, Essentially, that's what TraceMonkey is doing, is jitting JavaScript. And, why didn't they do this before now? Well, why has it taken this long, I guess that's the big question I have.
Kevin?
My comment on performance on Chrome was really that it felt a little snappier to me than Firefox, but I didn't have like the "oh my god, this is so amazingly fast" kind of reaction, which was my reaction on Firefox 3. Like, I was kind of blown away by Firefox 3's JavaScript performance improvement over 2. So, but I suspect that's partly because current, Ajaxy websites have constrained themselves to run reasonably well in the current generation of web browsers, and my suspicion is that Google, is building for the next generation of web browsers or of web applications, of Ajax applications. I suspect as Chrome and as these new browser JavaScript engines come out, we'll start see them being pushed a little bit more than the current generation stuff has been.
One thing that's interesting with Chrome's V8 engine, and also I've been playing just today a little bit with Firefox 3.1 and TraceMonkey, and both of those are using multi-threaded JavaScript, which causes some, it can break some things. I guess supposedly if everything works just fine under the hood, we shouldn't notice a difference, but my assumption is probably that people are not writing safe code that assumes things could come in at different orders. One other thing that's interesting about V8 is that it's not just jitting, it's not compiling only to bytecode, it's compiling down to native machine code, which is kind of wild. And I don't know how they pull that off, you know, because JavaScript is so dynamic. They must evaluate the whole thing.
Well, how do they Smalltalk or Ruby?
They depend on some common scenarios coming up. I was actually playing around with the V8 source code this week and trying to get it to build, which I was unsuccessful because of my Windows SDK setup seems to be fouled up. But it's just interesting to look through the source code and see some of the things they're doing and some of the approaches that they take. That just what they're trying to do is take your common web page, the common way people use JavaScript, and optimize for that case. So being able to cache property gets to make those really quick so it doesn't even involve a dictionary lookup. It's essentially a three machine code instructions and just dereferencing a pointer as long as that property is there. So it's pretty speedy. I think eventually Internet Explorer is going to have to ditch their existing script engine and maybe pick up on the managed JScript language that they have coming along that'll rely on the .NET jitter and garbage collector to catch up.
That's actually kind of surprising to me that that they haven't done that or even talked about it or anything. I mean, who knows? The way the IE team works is so, you know, they act like they're the secret thought leaders of the browser world. But, you know, they may be playing with that. But I'm just surprised that by now everyone else is optimizing using some really advanced technologies, and the IE team is optimizing a COM Olay JScript engine. When they do have this cool DLR, you know, managed code engine. I'm sure that, I understand too that IE has legacy support in mind, that it's the oldest code base and is probably the most complex to work with, but it does seem like that would be a path to moving forward. Scott?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, there's the problem is that the there are so many places in the OS and in apps where they use the IE, you know, rendering engine, and there's so many places where you know, things are scripted, and there's so many apps, third-party apps, that are built against the COM interface of IE and the scripting engine. I don't see how they'll ever, you know, it's the classic Microsoft story. You know, they're trying to keep backwards compatibility, and they're just, you know, hampered by their success. We were talking about the other night at our Liquid dinner you know, maybe someone just needs to skunkworks a browser at Microsoft. You know, just throw a tarball up on CodePlex and, you know, here's a new rendering engine, you know, we've been kind of playing with. Here's a new browser interface. You know, what do you guys think? And, you know, maybe just keep IE and their rendering engine in there for, you know, the stuff it's used for in the OS and the compiled help and whatnot, and, you know, release a new consumer or a enterprise browser.
It seems like, you know, like we're hearing about Windows Midori, and, you know, if you follow Mary Jo Foley or anyone else, that, you know, Midori is the vision of this managed operating system and finally the kind of from scratch Windows successor. And if you look back a little bit, you know, there was Singularity, which is out on CodePlex right now, which is Microsoft research project for a managed operating system. And I think really that's the way to go about this kind of stuff. I think that I would hope to see that sort of thing, that somebody in Microsoft Research is trying to file new browser and, you know, putting something out. I think too that the IE team, I just wonder about their thought process, because they, you know, you read what they write on their blog, which is about the only way they communicate, and it's like, we're reinventing the browser. And it's just strange because they're like, in a lot of ways, they're kind of limping along in last place, and they're like reinventing the race, you know. And it's just not in a way that catches them up, just in a way that leaves you kind of wondering what they're doing. Kevin?
Yeah, I think this is an area where Microsoft's decision to embed IE in the operating system, while expeditious in the short run, might end up really hurting them in the long run. That while IE is part of the operating system, it's incredibly burdensome for them to, you know, make major changes to it and really innovate on it. They have to maintain backward compatibility. The testing effort on a new version of the browser must be insane. You can only support one version of the browser installed on a machine, you know, officially speaking anyways. So, you know, I also wonder whether that whole approach just has to be chucked, and they need to go back to the standalone browser model, which will let them work more quickly.
Yeah, and what we were talking about with Kevin and Brad and I were talking about is, like, there's no reason that they have to chuck what's in Explorer and Windows if they create a standalone browser. You know, they could just, they're side by side, and Windows has its own HTML rendering system, which continues to work, but now they've got a new browser that's able to take advantage of some of the great things that are coming out of, you know, the newest technologies coming out of Microsoft instead of some of the older ones. Okay, Scott, I'm just interested in anything else you picked up out of looking at the V8 source code. Miguel de Acasa said that he thought that the source code was really very clean, that he was, in general, for Chrome. Was that your experience? Was it easy to follow?
I didn't look at the Chrome code. I looked just at the V8 code, which is a separate repository. And as far as C++ code goes, it's pretty clean. It's still kind of irritating nowadays to look at C++, I hate to admit, but there's jitters in there, not just for x86, but also for the ARM processors. So I imagine we'll be seeing a mobile version of this at some point.
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be in Android whenever, you know, the first Android phone ships, I guess. Well, what I thought was interesting about Chrome is the same thing that I thought was interesting when Air was announced and Nokia. A lot of people, when they're looking for a rendering engine, a HTML rendering engine, are basing off of WebKit. They're not going with Gecko or I don't know if you could actually license the IE rendering engine or not. But
Trident.
Trident, yeah.
Which actually Trident, my understanding is IE8 is they're moving away, like it's the first one where they're not using Trident. It's a rewrite.
That's kind of what I thought was funny was, you know, that, I mean, Nokia, when they were looking for a web browser for their phone with WebKit, Android was always going to be based off of WebKit. Now it looks like it'll be based off of Chrome, which is based off of WebKit. Adobe Air picked WebKit for their browser to embed in their desktop runtime. It's everywhere. And the number one comment that I've heard about WebKit is that the code base is very clean and it's very easy to pick up on. And that's primarily why these people are adopting it so much.
So what's the history? I guess WebKit's based on KHTML, and KHTML,
right,
was, I'm looking on Wikipedia, I don't know this off the top of my head here.
That was the rendering engine used in the Conqueror web browser on KDE on Linux.
You know, I remember looking at Linux and looking at Conqueror and just cracking up, because I was like, seriously, Conqueror? Like, just, I don't know, it just seems so silly to me, you know, like, Conqueror, why bother with this, you know, and it's funny that, you know, that is one of the leading browser engines right now.
Yeah, well, they kind of forked off of Conqueror or KHTML, and then they've been putting things back in, but yeah, it's a little like, you know, they started dating KHTML's girlfriend and now they're married with kids, and KHTML is sitting there thinking, you know, that could have been me. Why wasn't I good enough?
So I do wonder what the difference is with WebKit over Gecko. Like, I'm not sure why Gecko it was passed, or you know, why it's only used in Firefox.
There was actually a really interesting article that I read, I think it was today actually, about WebKit versus Gecko, and you know, some people have said Firefox should just drop Gecko and go with WebKit, and I'll have to dig up the link, but it was an interesting history. Supposedly Gecko is kind of a messy code base, or was originally, and was like twice the size of WebKit, and it just had a lot of sort of legacy crud in it, but has been improved dramatically in the sort of 3.0 Firefox generation. And there's an analysis of why maintaining Gecko makes more sense than just embedding WebKit. I don't remember what all the arguments were, but I'll see if I can dig up the link for the blog.
One thing that is different, or and I'm not sure if this causes complexity in Firefox, but that Firefox is really built so that JavaScript and CSS are really kind of native to the system, and a lot of things in the Chrome run on JavaScript and CSS, and definitely plugins run, that plugin architecture runs on that. And I think that that's been a key success with Firefox. Although a lot of the cool features that I use plugins for with Firefox are just kind of built into Chrome, so I don't know how necessary that is. But I do wonder if that's something where Firefox may be more complex in order to support the rich plugin system. Scott?
Well, but there's a difference between Firefox, the browser, which is based on the Chrome, is all based on Zool, the runtime engine, and the Gecko rendering engine, which is really separate. And when people are adopting like WebKit or Gecko, they're not adopting the entire browser platform. They're just grabbing the rendering engine and then writing their own host around it. And most of the comments that I've seen are that you know, Gecko is just, or WebKit, they never say Gecko is bad. They always say WebKit is very clean and very easy for the developers to get in and understand and start working with almost immediately. So I don't know how much, you know, that I don't know how much the Chrome and the dependency of Zool on Gecko kind of plays into it, but I don't think it's as important as all that. Yeah, there's been a whole lot of the air quote journalist articles coming out and hinting that Google is going to acquire, you know, Mozilla, or you know, Mozilla is going to dump Gecko and adopt the Chrome WebKit rendering engine and V8 and all this junk. And you know, it's, I don't know, you can't really read tech journalists, because the tech part of tech journalist is a misnomer. These people haven't coded a day in their life, or if they had, it was 30 years ago in BASIC, and they don't really understand, you know, how things work under the hood. And when you start talking about, you know, oh, this means that Google is going to acquire Mozilla, or Mozilla is going to start using V8 instead of Gecko. And you're like, well, no, I've seen those quotes. They're going to use V8 instead of Gecko. And I'm like, oh, well, that's great. So they're going to render everything using JavaScript? And they just, you know, they just miss out on the tech part of tech journalism. Those tech podcasters, too, they're full of crap.
Hate them. So, you know, a lot of the stuff about Chrome was about the V8 and about speed and stuff, but they did some nice user experience stuff with Chrome as well. I was curious what you guys' take on that was. I was pretty impressed with some of the stuff that they did.
One huge thing that I just love is the ability to tear tabs off. And, you know, it's not something that I'm going to do all the time, but it's great to be able to just say, here's Gmail. I see Gmail as a separate application. That's cool.
Safari has had that for a while, and it is a beautiful thing. But, you know, Chrome took that and put whipped cream and buttercream frosting and a cherry on top and made it so that you could create application shortcuts, which are great. So if you think Gmail should be its own separate tab, you just say create application shortcuts, and then it creates a shortcut in your desktop, your quick launch, your start menu, and allows you to start up a new instance of Chrome without all the browser border around it, just as if it's running like a standard Windows app. And the second thing they did to really put the cherry on top of that was to embed Google Gears in the browser, which, you know, kind of goes without saying, but I guess I said it. And so what you've got there is you've got the ability to, if you want to target Chrome, you can write desktop apps using standard web technologies and Gears to create, you know, just kind of the same thing you get with Air. You get to make multiple asynchronous AJAX requests using the worker processes in Google Gears. Could they come up with something harder to say? You've got the SQLite database embedded for caching and working offline. It's really a shot across the bow at several different kind of technologies at once. The HTML5, you know, client-side storage persistence mechanism, I guess they're tired of waiting for the HTML5 specification to come about.
Our children will be tired of waiting for the HTML5 specification to come out.
You know, Mark Pilgrim has a blog where he talks about, you know, this day in HTML5. I guess he's on the working group for HTML5. And you Google for Mark Pilgrim HTML5, and you'll see he kind of talks about what they did that day or what they've done since the last time he posted, I guess. But I think those two things, coupled with the process, you know, per tab isolation, really kind of put the browser as an application host in a new light that, you know, we haven't really seen since, you know, when Zool was going to rule the world.
You know, as an application too, it really is nice that they have. I mean, it's just a geek's dream to be able to go in and look at the processes and see specifically which tab is doing what and which plugin is doing what, and you know, when you've got a browser with 20 tabs open and they're all really applications, you want to be able to see, you want to know more than just my browser is taking up 600 megabytes and 80% CPU. I want to know which one and what's going wrong. So that's a cool feature, I think.
Someone, I don't remember who had mentioned, I think it was just John Rezik, that it puts poor performance back in the hands of the developers, or the blame for poor web application performance. So now you can't say, well, there must be some plugins in some other tab that's running wild, or, you know, it's not us, it's the browser itself. Now you can tell, you know, hey, I went to, you know, this YouTube site and that process started taking up 400 megs. What, you know, what the heck? And 98% of my CPU time. I closed it and it went back to normal. There's no more of this wondering which tab is, you know, spiking the process this time.
So on usability features, a lot of people have pointed out that all these modern browsers now have something similar to the Firefox 3 Awesome Bar, which I know people got upset about at the time, but it just, the more you get used to it, I'm in love with it, you know. And it's like when I fired up IE8 Beta 2 and it had the same kind of features, like, yeah, of course, and Google Chrome as well. You just, and you know, you could kind of always work in the browser. Like I was talking to my friend about that, and he's like, I've always done that, you know, like the browser will just default to searching on Google if you type something that's not there. But it's great to have it autocomplete against titles and you know, titles of pages and favorites and history and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, the fact that they finally got rid of the distinction between the search box and the address bar, I think, is just like a total no-brainer. The average person will never understand the difference between those two anyways.
I remember the first time I my dad a link, and he kept saying, I can't get it to come up. And I'm like, it's there. I tried it, you know, and finally, so I keep searching Google for it and that link doesn't come up. And that was always what he did when he got a link, was he Googled for it and then clicked on the link in Google. And, you know, in a way it's like, that makes sense. You know, I mean, there's things to it where it's like, if Google's the start page of the internet, then you need to get that page to show up in Google. I mean, it just does make sense. Like you're saying, to merge those two together.
Yeah, you always hear the stories about how one of the top 10 searches on Google is Yahoo. Like, in order to find Yahoo, people don't go to yahoo.com, they search Google for Yahoo. I mean, that's just how people find websites. They don't understand URLs, really, for the most part.
What about CSS? One thing that I've noticed with browsers is CSS support is getting to be just kind of an expected thing. Now that IE is getting up to the standards, people are just kind of expecting that, you know, it's nice when people say, yeah, we're ACID 2 compliant, or we support CSS 2.1, but it's not really even something to brag about at this point. Like, everyone supports that. Are you guys seeing that as well?
Almost everyone supports it.
The exception being?
IE still has some issues, I think, with some CSS support. Although they've gotten a ton better.
Yeah, IE8 Beta 2, when I last checked, and I'll try it now. ACID 2. My understanding here, I'm going to take this ACID 2 test. I don't care. I'm feeling crazy. Yeah, it passes.
Go crazy.
Go, John. It's done. I'm done going. It's done. So, yeah, IE8 Beta 2 passes ACID 2. And ACID 2 is not a feature-by-feature testing absolutely everything, but it does do a pretty good test of CSS 2.1 support. I'm developing using IE8 and Firefox 2 or 3, and then usually everything just pretty much works. And then I'll go in and do some fixes for IE7 and 6 and call it a day. But usually, if it works in IE8, it's going to work in the other browsers.
So the IE8 JavaScript engine may be improved in terms of performance, but as far as language spec goes, I think they're still stuck in the mid-90s with ECMA 3, or like 3.5, which is equivalent to, what is it, JScript 6, I think it is. So it's kind of disappointing. There's lots of stuff that Mozilla added in JavaScript 1.7 and 1.8. That would be nice to have, you know, across all three browsers. Iterators, generators, map and reduce on arrays, things like that.
One practical example of something we're waiting for with IE, I believe, is E4X, which is ECMA script for Java for XML, which is just a way to query XML, and it's been released as a spec since, I think, 2002. I guess it is dead. I don't know. What are some things that we don't have in IE8's support? You're talking about generators, some other stuff that was over my head. Is there anything else that we're missing out on?
Oh, those were the big ones I could think of. There's a list at the Mozilla developer site where they talk about what's new in 1.6, 1.7, 1.8, any others. There was a bit there. I can look it up and we can spend all evening discussing the shortcomings of the IE JavaScript engine.
So it, you know, it's interesting that you were saying, isn't E4X dead? This is kind of an interesting question because as I'm looking up, Mozilla says that they at least partly supported in SpiderMonkey. Which SpiderMonkey was the Firefox?
SpiderMonkey is the Firefox 3.0 engine. And 3.1 is going to be TraceMonkey.
So E4X is a standard that is supported by Mozilla. I would bet that it's supported. I wouldn't be surprised if it's supported by Safari, Opera, and Chrome. And so then you get into a question where it's like, it is dead because IE doesn't support it. But if IE supported it, you'd have 100% support, and then it would be a feature that's everywhere. And I always get into this discussion with people when I'm excited about the idea of SVG, only because I think most images on the web are completely unnecessary. You know, you look around at most websites and there's so many images that are just very simple graphics. But this is another situation where it's like SVG isn't dead. Well, yeah, it is because IE doesn't support it. But if you look at every single other major browser, they all support SVG. So it's the kind of thing where if IE supported SVG, then it would be what's the word I'm looking for? Ubiquitous?
I think E4X is dead because everyone is using JSON in JavaScript development. It's much easier. There's no
good
parsing. There's no nothing.
XML sucks, man. Haven't you heard? Well, hey, just to take it back to the Chrome user experience stuff a little bit, we called out a few things that were kind of cool. I noticed a few others, like I thought the new Find bar in Chrome is really quite nice. I don't know if you guys have played around with that. The inline search, you know, has hit highlighting and it tells you how many hits are on the page. It's really quite nice. But there's also some really kind of wacky usability gaffes, I think. I don't know if you guys have noticed that. And I don't know how much of this is just it's pre-beta early stuff. But, like lack of keyboard accelerators. The options dialog looks really, really clunky. There's definitely some areas where I think they have some work to do on the user experience. Oh, and the killer for me is that zooming is not full page zoom, which I've gotten completely addicted to now in Firefox and in IE.
I like the zoom too. I feel like an old man zooming in, but I do it.
I've noticed some oddness running it over remote desktop. Sometimes the Chrome around the sides of the window, you know, won't quite render correctly. It'll render black instead of blue or something else. And sometimes the top, I don't know what you'd call that, the top bar where the maximize, minimize, close buttons are will somehow get lowered and behind my tabs so that they don't actually accept clicks. So the only way you can minimize, maximize is by clicking in the, or restore and minimize is by clicking in the task bar. But I've just been chalking that up to beta code, first release kind of stuff. But it makes me wonder what they're doing with the UI. If they're you know, writing lots of their own UI widgets just to make it portable at some point in the future, or you know, cross-platform.
Right. So, one thing that the IE team did recently, which I was unhappy with the IE 8 compatibility mode switching via meta tag in beta 1. With beta 2, they made some changes which make it a lot smoother, and one thing that they did was they said that IE8 for intranet will allow you to say for everything on my intranet render as IE7, and a lot of people got really upset about that, one person being the CTO of Opera writing this big inflammatory piece, but I think it was a good move because it allows it's taking away the excuse that holds back IT managers from upgrading all their browsers. You know, it's easier now to just say, we'll stick with IE6. All our sites work in IE6. Now they don't really have that excuse. They can upgrade to IE8 and all their intranet sites will still continue to work with the old rendering mode. Does anyone not like that? Now that I've told you what the right answer is?
I personally would have been perfectly happy for them to always default into IE7 mode, even on the internet, to take it even a step further, if only because the more sites that are broken, the slower people are going to upgrade to IE8. And I think getting people up onto IE8 is absolutely the most important thing. And then, because then we can start taking advantage of all this great new feature support, you know, standard support. So I certainly don't have any problem with it. I probably would have gone even further with it.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp with that. I think that I fall on the pragmatic side. You know, a lot of people were taking the idealistic approach and saying Microsoft should render with the latest standards and anything less is unacceptable, but that kind of leaves you in the spot where people just stay on their old browsers, and I think getting on the new browsers is just key to moving beyond this develop for IE6 world that we're in.
That does bring up another point. Why are all these damn intranets so browser specific? Why is corporate America, or at least their software devs, why are they writing, you know, stuff just for one browser? Is it because it's easier? Is that because, MS Education has been teaching them the drag and drop RAD development methodology for so long that, you know, that's all they can do, that's all they know, and that drag and drop stuff is just IE specific.
So I've been in a couple places where the directive has gone out that we're developing an internet application. Everybody inside of this network is going to be running IE6. Therefore, that's all you need to test and develop for. So I think it just becomes the path of least resistance.
Yeah, I agree. I think that cross-browser development isn't that hard, but it does take some skill and it takes some practice. And I think that in general, it's the kind of thing where if it's easier to just cut costs and not worry about training up developers to handle it, it's easier to just say, we'll just do this. I think also there definitely was, like if you look at a site like Outlook, what is it, Outlook Web Access, that site will, no matter what you do, it's never going to run in Firefox because it's using specific ActiveX controls. And so I think once people kind of go down that road, there's no real point. Outlook Web Access, I'm sorry, it does have a down-level view, which will work in Firefox, but it's not the same experience that you get in IE.
If you use Microsoft Tools and you use Microsoft Help, while I don't necessarily think it's a deceptive, you know, practice that they're doing, but they sort of subtly push you toward IE, IE ways of doing things. Like, the MSDN help is all about IE's version of HTML and not about the standard version of HTML. And the IntelliSense gives you IE-specific stuff and doesn't necessarily restrict you to standards-only stuff. So, you know, if there's no imperative to develop for cross-browsers, which I think most of the time is the case in corporations, like, who cares? Most people are not going to be running, you know, almost everybody in the company is going to be running IE, so why should I bother doing anything more? Then, you know, the tools do kind of lead you down that path, not necessarily for evil reasons, but just because that's the way, you know, it's all kind of set up.
Yeah, when you're developing in Visual Studio, and, you know, those of us who were reared on Visual Basic and even those of us reared on Visual C++, maybe less so. But, you know, the way you find out how you need to do something is you hit F1. And, you know, F1 brings up MSDN help that's installed now. So, you know, a lot of people that are doing development inside of Visual Studio, that's the only help they look for. They don't think to, you know, Google around and find out if there's a library out there that will maybe make the cross-platform part a little bit easier. Or if there's a different way of doing it that's, you know, just as easy or, you know, maybe not... Or maybe even easier than the IE way of doing it.
I hear some interesting reactions too when a new browser comes out, and it's a standards compliant browser. But people will be like, "Oh, great! Why can't we all just use IE?" And I think that a lot of people just don't really think about it as like, if we all run on standards compliant browsers, it really doesn't matter how many browsers are out there. I think the reaction, especially in the Microsoft community, that I'll hear is like, you know, standards are a figment of everyone's imagination. There's no such thing as standards. People just make stuff up, and I'd like to code for this browser because that's what everyone's using.
Well, it used to be that IE was innovating and extending the browser in useful ways and ways that, you know, were helpful to devs. Let's not forget they were the first ones to come up with XML HTTP request. They also... Back in, what, 98, 99, earlier than that, even 95, they had XML data islands and remote scripting. Very innovative things for the time. And then they just, you know, they got their browser market share and they quit. So people are less likely to give Microsoft the benefit of the doubt when it comes to browsers anymore. Yeah, they've got a tougher road to hoe because they screwed up.
I think it's interesting, the whole sad story of Microsoft inventing the Ajax tools and then not getting credit for it, but that really comes from the fact that Microsoft never really made public-facing websites that leveraged Ajax. You know, they had the Outlook Web Access, which is a remarkable thing, especially considering when they built it, but the only way you were going to use it was if you bought Exchange. And so to the... A lot of the world, the first time that they saw Ajax was when they fired up, you know, Google Maps or Gmail. Scott?
Well, see, the problem was that they just didn't have anything for XML HTTP request inside of the MSDN help. There was no drag and drop, XHR component in a Visual Interdev.
Right, but I'm not even talking just about the developer experience. I'm talking about Microsoft never leveraged that in a public way. I think if Microsoft had bought into they have a lot of web properties, and if they had made use of Ajax, say, and I don't know what was going on then, Hotmail or MSN or something, in a way that really was innovative, I think that people would have seen the use of it, and they would have gotten the credit for the innovation that they were driving at that point. It's kind of interesting too that Microsoft is the one vendor in the browser market that has a browser and a browser extension plugin. I mean, I guess Apple has QuickTime, but it's not quite the same as Flash or Silverlight is. So I think that in a way, there's some things that Microsoft is not in a hurry to implement because it's built into, and it's a competitive feature in Silverlight. For instance, the fast execution engine with managed code, the vector layout system. Firefox 3.1 has the video element, which would mean if that was widely supported, that's an HTML5 element, but if that was widely supported, there's no need to load up Flash or Silverlight or anything to display video unless you're doing something complex with it. But Microsoft's got video and media rendering built into Silverlight. And I'm a big fan of Silverlight, but I'd like to see Silverlight's innovation be in things that aren't available in all the other browsers just out of the box.
We talked about Silverlight in an earlier show, and like I said, I think we're going to get some interesting technologies out of it, but I think it's relegated to the video player niche. It's the newest ActiveX video player browser plugin, I think. The DLR, the Core CLR, all that stuff is really interesting, but what are you going to do? You can do SVG layout. All the things you can do with Silverlight, you can do with Flash currently, but people don't because they've learned that that's not a good thing. And the one thing that Flash is really locked into is video playing. And so I think we may see a plug-in war between Silverlight and Flash as far as who can do full screen the fastest, who can do the highest definition, blah blah blah. But I don't. Do we need another, drop down widget that, blinks?
I do wonder whether Silverlight has sort of missed its window. Aside from the video stuff, which, as John pointed out, might, be addressed in the next version of Firefox, all the sort of key scenarios for things like Silverlight and Flash are like really rich interactivity and really smooth animation. CSS and JavaScript, as these engines improve, is probably going to be good enough. Some guy wrote a cover flow sort of simulation in JavaScript. If you've used the iPod cover flow UI, if you run it on Firefox 3, it's kind of clunky and like really not very smooth and kind of jerky, animation as the covers flow. But you run it on Safari and especially on Chrome, and it's like super smooth, and that's just CSS and JavaScript. So I do wonder whether that key area that Silverlight's targeting is going to be passed. The browsers are going to pass it by and make it sort of moot.
The one comment I wanted to say on Silverlight, still a compelling advantage there, is that you're able to build and debug and design using some pretty nice tools. Expression Blend continues to mature. Visual Studio is a nice integrated development environment. And you're using the same kind of tools. If you're in the ASP.NET world especially, you're using the same kind of tools and development style that you're using for everything else. And So I just think that does make a difference, that there's no super smooth development environment that gives you the same kind of speed of building and same kind of development experience if you're in the CSS, JavaScript, you know, and then moving on to these other edge technologies like SVG. There's just no super smooth, everything wrapped up environment like Blend and Visual Studio are for Silverlight.
It's true, and I think that is a major factor in certain environments, but if you're a company targeting the broader web, doing public websites, the requirement for the extra runtime and all that stuff, I tend to think that the tooling is not going to make up for the fact that you have this extra piece that you, you know, need to deploy to the clients, and it's not just pure cross-platform web stuff. But in the intranet, in the corporate environment, as a way of delivering rich internet applications, I can see that as being a pretty significant advantage, especially because those guys don't, as we know, don't want to muck around with cross-platform CSS and, you know, standards and all that crap.
The tooling is certainly, you know, an issue in the web development world. The tooling still hasn't caught up in HTML, you know, web development as far as they have with the, say, like Windows Forms or XAML development. But one of the interesting points that you brought up, John, was, you know, you can develop in Silverlight using C# inside of Visual Studio, debug, and everything like that. So what I'm starting to see more and more outside of just JavaScript libraries that provide extra functionality or, you know, new document methods you can call to kind of smooth out the cross-platform issues is I'm starting to see some people implementing entire languages on top of JavaScript. One that I've been looking at the past couple of days is an implementation of Objective-C in JavaScript called Objective-J, and they've recreated the Cocoa framework, or lots of parts of the Cocoa framework, like core animation and core foundation AppKit, which is kind of the low-level APIs for Objective-C development on OS X. A couple of ex-Apple guys released this framework, and the whole point behind that was to write the same kind of code that they're writing for their OS X desktop apps as they are for writing their web apps. One of the things they included is a SIB file format. OS X uses a NIB file format, which is kind of what they call the freeze-dried interface. It's similar to XAML, but it kind of works a little bit better in that you draw out the interfaces, and since Cocoa development is strictly adheres to the model view controller kind of framework, you then just wire up your interfaces to your controller class. And the entire UI is then freeze-dried as executable code and loaded and executed, instantiated at runtime. And so for this Cappuccino framework that they've created SIB files, and they have a tool in their toolkit called Nib2Sib, which purports to allow you to draw your interface using the standard OS X interface builder, save that as a nib, use this tool to convert it to a SIB, and then run it inside of your web browser. And I think that going forward, you know, certainly, you know, the Silverlight tooling kind of way of development where you develop everything in Expression Blend and then, you know, just kind of decide where you want to, that's not what I'm trying to say. I think the XAML method where you define you draw out your user interface using Expression Blend or the Visual Studio Cider Designer or whatever, and then you decide what you want to target. Do you want to target Silverlight? Do you want to target web HTML plus JavaScript? Do you want to target, WPF? I kind of think that's the way that this is moving at this point. And it's kind of exciting. And with the new enhancements to the JavaScript engines, you know, running at native speeds, JITting, the ability to build, you know, implement these kind of languages on top of JavaScript is kind of becoming a reality.
I don't know how to respond to that. It sounds exciting.
Just one comment on that. I can't obviously speak about Objective-J. I haven't really looked at it, but I'm generally skeptical when I hear, you know, we've taken this model over here and ported it to this platform over here. You know what I mean? It's like somehow that never seems to quite work. We've taken Objective J and ported it to JavaScript. We've taken, I don't know, the whole Sprout Core thing of like making a web browser look like a desktop application. I'm skeptical of that approach. I feel like, you know, they're different environments, and you really want to leverage the strength of that environment instead of just porting some other environment's model to it. Maybe they can do it with Objective-J, but I'm a skeptic on that front.
All right, that's all the time we have this week. Join us next week on Nerding Code.
Trident, yeah.
Which actually, my understanding is IE8 is they're moving away. Like, it's the first one where they're not using Trident. It's a rewrite. So what's that crazy noise?
What the hell was that?
Who's writing on a whiteboard?
No, seriously.
Was that me? I've been in a couple places where they've said this is an intranet app. Everyone inside of this network is going to be running IE6. Therefore, that's the only thing you're going to develop and test for.
I'm sorry, I've got that squeakiness going on. Can you say that again?
I've been in a couple places. Jesus.
Okay, right. So. One, there it is, a squeaky, weird noise.
It's so bizarre.